Welcome to the Cascadian Prophets Podcast, a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, empowering people to practice poetry and deepen connections to place, self, and the present moment.
The Ridge is a poem in 20 parts, a meditation on a geological feature of Quadra Island, a large island in British Columbia just north of the Strait of Georgia and thus the Salish Sea. But the poem is also a meditation on what's happening on the island and on the planet we share, in what's been described as devastating imagery. I would add that it's a meditation on the human species as well, at this time in the early Anthropocene. Robert Bringhurst is the author. Trained initially in the sciences at MIT, he makes his life in the humanities from his home on Quadra Island, where he's worked in poetry, Native American linguistics, and typography. An officer of the Order of Canada, former Guggenheim Fellow, and winner of the Lieutenant Governor's Award for Literary Excellence, he's our guest today to talk about The Ridge. Robert, thanks for your time and hospitality.
Yeah, thank you, Paul.
Paraphrasing your friend Gary Snyder, bioregionalism is about staying put and watching what happens, but he didn't mean watching what happens for 400 million years, did he?
He probably did. You know, that's no stretch for Gary. Time is a very elastic substance, and if you pick up a pebble or a pine cone and you look at it, you think it's there in the moment, but it has a long history. And the pine cone itself may have grown last year, but how long did the tree spend learning to make pine cones? The rock might have been formed a billion years ago. Who knows? Been around. Knows a lot of things. Has something to tell you.
You said at the 7th Cascadia Poetry Festival that you started writing The Ridge about the time of the 3rd Cascadia Poetry Festival in Nanaimo, BC, 2015. Can you talk about that and the initial inspiration for the poem?
Well, I guess the initial inspiration for the poem was my moving here, which I did some 20 years ago. I grew up in a highly mobile family. I was an only child. My father was always looking for, greener grass somewhere. And so my family moved almost every year, the three of us. We lived in some splendid places in Utah and Montana and Wyoming and Alberta. But the idea of staying in one place just never came up. You know, it wasn't the thing that I grew up doing. I heard people talk about how it was terribly wrenching for children to be moved from one place to another because they would lose their friends and have to start all over again. I never had that experience. Moving was something I looked forward to. It was an adventure. Of course, I didn't have to do the work of moving. As a little kid, I wasn't even packing boxes and loading trucks, but I liked moving because I didn't know anything else. And whatever friendships I made were, transitory ones. And well, this continued into my adult life, and when I came to the West Coast in 1973, to go to grad school in Vancouver, I really liked the place, and I thought, some people actually live in a place they don't move every year. I wonder what it would be like to do this. And actually, Vancouver's been sort of, my home metropolis, the not necessarily where I lived, but the some place not too far from where I lived ever since then. How long is that? 50, 60 years? Can't be 60, must be 50. Still, I moved a lot. I mean, from one house to another, one island to another. Spent a lot of time in Europe and spent a lot of time in South America and spent some time in Asia. And I kept coming back to the West Coast. Finally, I just had it with cities. I couldn't do urban life anymore. And I came up here to Quadra Island and bought an old wreck of a house and started rebuilding it, and my life contracted considerably, and then by contracting it expanded. See, I really started to want to stay home, and that was a profound change for me. I just never lived that way before. Of course, I was part of the literary world in a sense in two countries at least, the standard doctrine was, the land is the source of all wisdom, and we all rooted in place. We all said this, but it wasn't necessarily true. You know, a lot of people were no more rooted in place than a potted plant. You could pick them up and take them someplace else, and they would scarcely notice that it was different. And there were Chinese restaurants and Mexican restaurants and French restaurants in every town or in every block. And we were all just floating on the surface of things, not rooted. Here, I really began to stay home, and then I began to discover what that meant, because I had never known before. The ridge. I live on the house is on the flank of this ridge, Harriet Ridge. It's nothing much as geological features go, but it's the one that's here. And the more I looked at it, the more fascinated I became. You know, I spend a lot of time hiking. I've done that since I was about 12 years old. So I've come to know a lot of forests and some mountain ranges, and it's not that I was unacquainted with the natural world, but I began to look at this specific part of it very intensely, and to get interested in the geological history of it and the botanical and zoological and human history of it in a way that I had never done any place else. So, of course, this began to show up in my writing, and some of that growing sense of place turned into this poem, which, of course, when I began it, I had no idea how long it was going to be or what shape it was going to be or where it would take me. That's part of the fun. I worked on it for about 8 years, and I thought it was probably finished. At the Cascadia Festival in Nanaimo that you mentioned, I must have been working on it for about a year at that point, and the first few sections were pretty well finished. I remember reading the first section of the poem at that festival, and felt good. People listened to it. I could have read another 4 or 5 pages, perhaps, but that's all I had at that point. And if you'd asked me where is this poem going to go and how long is it going to be, I couldn't have told you. So it was an adventure, and it lasted as long as it did. And things find their shape.
Are there models that you consider to be predecessors of this poem? Poems that you admire that got into you, and that in part it's an homage to?
It's certainly not modeled on any specific work, but I think there's a lot of Lucretius there. It's not written in Latin hexameters. It doesn't look like an ancient Roman poem, but Lucretius is an ancestor of this poem because he was one of the people who thought that you could do science and art at the same time. And Empedocles, too, although he was probably legally insane, he was a biologist of a kind as well as a poet. And Snyder, of course, with his Mountains and Rivers, and Mr. Pound with his cantos, Mr. Eliot with his quartets. These are all ancestors of mine. Some of them people I probably wouldn't like very much if I met them. Some of them people I have met and do love. You know, that's the way it goes. Some philosophers with really interesting ideas turn out to be dreadful human beings. Why? How can this happen? But it does. So if it were a really good, I'm getting to be old enough that I should have a kind of old man's view of literature, and it ought to include everything, right? It ought to include all the literatures of my species in all places and all times. Well, I'm not nearly that well read and never will be, but I've spent the last 30 years of my life working fairly seriously at Native American languages and their oral literatures, and so a lot of that is seeped in to this work, to other things that I do, but not in the sense of, you know, I'm going to model my work on this, or I'm going to model this piece on that piece. It's just stuff that I have been marinated in over these years.
Can you talk about your work at MIT and your interest in the sciences that informed this poem?
When I was young, I thought the sciences were probably where I would spend my life. Physics excited me, and astronomy excited me. When I got to MIT, I went there. I came out of high school early, and my father, who had very little education, was impressed with the science and engineering, and he thought it would be really nice for me to go to MIT. Of course, he'd never been there, but he'd heard about it. I'd never been east of Denver at that point in my life, and I knew nothing about the world of academia, nothing about the Ivy League, nothing about any of that. But I came out of high school early, and so I was 16 years old, and I piled my stuff into a car and drove to Boston and Cambridge, and got myself a place to live, and I knew nothing. I was socially unprepared and intellectually unprepared and temperamentally unprepared for the experience of a real university, never mind a technically minded school. And the teaching was lousy. the physics lectures were terrible, and the tutorials were even worse. I'd done a lot of this stuff already, you know. It was what I did was math and physics at that stage, and these bad teachers were trying to teach me stuff I already knew. So I started reading a lot of poetry at that point. When the second term of the year came along, it was a semester system, not a quarterly system at MIT. The second semester came along, I discovered there was a humanities program there. You couldn't get a degree in it, but they had courses, and they had real humanistic scholars on the staff. I took some literature courses there, I met Noam Chomsky and began to find my way out of the math and physics side of things. And by the end of the year, I'd sort of walked myself off the end of the pier and taken a plunge into something else. I didn't know what it was. So that was the end of my scientific education that had really barely begun. I continued reading physics. I still do read physics, but being at MIT gave me an opportunity to see actual physicists at work, you know, and I didn't like it at all. these guys didn't walk around as I imagined they did, all by themselves, dreaming up ideas and then write them down on pieces of paper and publish them in journals and change the world. They've worked in teams, they formed committees, they got million-dollar grants and built fantastic, intricate machinery and ran experiments and tabulated the results, and there was an awful lot of statistics and there was an awful lot of administration, and it didn't look like any fun at all. Physics, I didn't know this at the time, but I had conceived physics as a kind of poetry. You know, people falling in love with ideas and following them wherever they led, and not working in committees, and not having to get mammoth grants in order to build mammoth pieces of equipment to run arcane experiments. That's still my idea of how to do physics, but nobody does physics that way anymore. It's been a long time since they did. Things have got a lot worse in the scientific world, in my terms, since those days, since the 1960s, because now the computer links all physicists together, and the committees that they form, the teams that they form, are much larger, and the pieces of equipment that they build are some of the biggest and most expensive pieces of equipment that have ever been built for any purpose. In order to make particles that nobody's ever seen before, that might only live for some tiny fraction of a millisecond. I'm happy that people are doing that. It's way better than blowing your neighbors out of the. Out of their village, but I have no interest in that kind of life, that kind of research. I want to think about things. So I just slid out of the world of the sciences into the world of the arts and of literature in particular. Then I've been happy here ever since.
Did you have much of a connection to Chomsky?
Not seriously, no. But he was already famous when I first met him. Not as famous as he became later, but famous enough. Syntactic Structures, his first book, was still vivid in the minds of many linguists, and it was a brilliant book. He'd also published American Power and the New Mandarins, and that, because I'd been, a kid from the sticks, in the sticks, all of this political stuff was just utterly new to me. I didn't even know what left and right meant in politics. I had no understanding of that at all. My parents were not political people. They voted, but they didn't work on campaigns and get involved and argue issues at the dinner table. I didn't hear or overhear any sort of political conversation growing up as a kid. It might be that Chomsky's political writing made a larger impact on me than his linguistic work, but there was a sense in which the linguistic work was comprehensible to me, and the political stuff was just so strange that I didn't at first know what to make of it. But it was the thing that started me thinking about politics. And so meeting Chomsky was kind of incidental. I mean, he, of course, was a busy guy, but he took his teaching seriously. His door was open, and a freshman student from nowhere like me could walk into his office and sit down and talk. So in those three ways, as a revolutionary linguist, as it turned out, very astute observer of world politics and American politics in particular, and as an example of how an intellectual might live and might be immersed in his work and yet generous with his time. In all three of those ways, Chomsky was and still is a kind of model for me. Is his linguistics the answer to everything? No. Is his political analysis the answer to everything? No. But they're good. They're genuine. He was a brilliant man. He is a brilliant man. An example of how one might try to live a real life.
His political ideas are about as close as anyone gets on this notion of empire and how empire engages in the world and what the ramifications are of that.
I've heard Chomsky say that he did his research on the politics of the Spanish Civil War when he was 12 years old. He was precocious, of course, in all respects, but you see, that's sort of otherworldly to me. When I was 12 years old, I didn't know there was a Spanish Civil War. Never mind, you know, that had an impact on the lives of millions of people, that it resonated through to the Cold War and back to other things, and that it had a serious impact on English literature too, because it drew people in who sometimes survived and whose thinking was transformed by this experience. Chomsky started early and he never stopped.
There's a great deal of history in the Ridge, especially as regards the fire on Quadra Island in the summer of 1925. Mm-hmm. Talk about the research on that and other historical events that inform the poem.
Well, it's a very localized poem. I mean, this is one of the rules of literature, which I must have learned like everybody else when I was 14 or something, probably from an English teacher whose name I don't even remember, that you know, if you want to make something universal, you make it local. You zero in, and the closer you get to the center of the hourglass, the more chance you have that the glass will expand at the farther reaches. So the poem goes back a long ways into geological history and forward into the astronomical future. And by those standards, the distance from 2023 or 2020 anything to 1925 is trivial, minute. But if you're going to be local in space, you're going to be local in time, too. When I first moved here, I didn't even know there'd been a fire. But of course, I didn't know anything about forest fires to speak of, except that they occurred. They were part of the landscape I grew up in. There are forest fires in Montana every summer, and there are forest fires in British Columbia every summer. And they were an abstraction to me. I'd never been in one. I knew nothing about the ecology of fire. Fire studies were in their infancy in those days. Well, I began walking the ridge and I began seeing these old burned trees. Some of them had been dead for decades. Some of them were still very much alive, wounded giants, wounded, contorted giant beings that bore the marks of this fire. And I went to the provincial archives, and I went to the local museum in Campbell River on Vancouver Island, and read old newspapers and read government reports from the early 20th century and discovered that the fire could be dated. There were quite remarkable, almost daily reports of when the fire was first discovered, how it moved, and also, of course, there were weather reports, so I could track the growth of the fire and the patterns of heat and cold and rainfall. And this became a story, a part of the poem. It became one of the central metaphors of the poem, the fact that humans are fire animals, that we play constantly with fire, and of course, as the proverb says, you sometimes get burned if you play with fire. And if you get so fascinated with fire that you can't do anything else except play with fire, you might get really seriously burned. That's pretty simplistic, but it's pretty true. It's one of many other things that I had never really thought about before, and I found myself thinking about it a great deal, and I found myself walking all over the island looking for these burned trees, looking at old forestry maps going back to the 1960s that showed burned areas, clear-cut areas, and I was able to piece together a rough history of the forest on the ridge and elsewhere on the island. In a sense, it's like I had walked into somebody else's house and found that it was full of really interesting stuff, and I just started helping myself to this stuff. Here I was, a newcomer to Quadra Island. This was, in a sense, none of my business, and it became my business because I immersed myself in it. I wasn't here in 1925. I didn't know anybody who had been here in 1925. I didn't have any relatives who had stories about this, and it was no part of my family tradition or my tribal tradition. But I became fascinated by the story, and as I came more and more to live here, it became more and more a story that was important to me, because it was the story of the place where I was setting down roots. The research was, in a sense, trivial. It was just looking at old forestry maps and old newspapers. It's no big deal. It's not thousands or millions of pages of data. I'm not talking about a story that goes back very far, except, of course, the forest goes back quite a ways, and a fire is part of the story of the forest always. It's there's never been a time when there weren't fires in forests like this one. And then, of course, it reaches into the future, because we have seen that there are now more and more fires every year in British Columbia and California and Washington and Oregon and Montana and in Greece and in Russia and in places that we never heard of before in terms of forest fire, fires in times of the year where they didn't occur 50 years ago. So the story not only became more and more important to me, it came to seem more and more relevant to the wider world. And I guess that's the way the hourglass principle works. You find it in the center, you'll find it everywhere else.
McClure said the way to the universal is by means of the most intensely personal.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're expressing.
Yeah, well, I'm leery of the personal myself. I don't. I'm not my favorite subject. You know, I don't especially want to know about people's personal lives, but I wanted to know about the life of this place. And so I had to immerse myself in this place in order to understand this place. So I'd rather think of it in terms of the local rather than the personal, but the sense in which those things become inseparable. See the light on that moss over there? That's just, you know, going to be there for a few minutes, but that's the real world. There's a timeless quality to that momentary vision. The world is luminous there, and because it's been and will be luminous for a moment, it's luminous forever.
Cascadian Prophet supporters include Diana Elser, a sponsorship dedicated to her parents, whose practicality, humor, and love of family life reflected their experience in and love for the Missouri Breaks and Ruby Valley, Montana landscapes that define their childhoods. And Steinbrook Native Gallery, located near Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, featuring fine art of the Northwest Coast from emerging and established artists. A link to their site at cascadianprophets.org. Cascadian Prophets is a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, founded in 1993. More interviews and lots of information on our website, cascadianprophets.org.